My featured musical this evening is Fiddler on the Roof, with music by Jerry Bock and lyrics by Sheldon Harnick, and we shall be listening to the 1971 film soundtrack recording, starring Topol as the milkman, Tevye. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Fiddler on the Roof, which premiered on Broadway at the Imperial Theatre on the 22nd of September 1964, and played for a then record-breaking run of 3,242 performances, winning 9 Tony Awards in the process, including those for Best Musical of the 1964-65 season and Best Score of a Musical, and a special award in 1972 on becoming the longest-running musical of its time. And now it is my very great pleasure to welcome to the program, via telephone from New York, the Tony Award-winning lyricist of Fiddler on the Roof, Sheldon Harnick. Good evening, Sheldon.
Hi, Rob.
Welcome to Australia.
Thank you. I'm glad to be there.
Have you ever visited Australia in person?
No. During the run of Fiddler, there was an Australian production, and we had the option of either going to Australia or going to Japan. And Japan seemed a little more exotic, so we chose Japan.
All right.
And we didn't get to Australia.
That's a shame. That was the original production back in 1967, I guess.
I think so, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Fiddler on the Roof was the fifth collaboration that you had with composer Jerry Bock, following The Body Beautiful, Fiorello, Tenderloin, and She Loves Me. And I believe this was the first project that you initiated yourselves instead of being called in to do the score.
That's right. Every other project had been, we had been approached by a producer and asked if we were interested in doing some show. But this one we started ourselves. Somebody had sent me a book by the author Shalom Aleichem. It was called Wandering Star, a big fat book about a Yiddish theatrical troupe touring Eastern Europe. I loved it, and I gave it to Jerry Bock to read, and he loved it. And we thought the right person to do the book would be a writer named Joe Stein. So we sent it to Joe. Mm-hmm. Joe read it, and he said, it is just too big. It would be too costly and too difficult to adapt it for the stage. So we dropped that idea. But Joe said, since we loved the writing, let's see what else we can find by this author, Shalom Aleichem. Mm-hmm. And so we started reading other things. We found the Tevye's Daughter stories, and we thought, that's what we want to do. So we did a musical based on the disparate stories called Tevye's Daughters.
Ah, great. And you'd worked with the producer, Hal Prince, before, of course. Was he the logical person to approach?
Well, he was the first person we approached, and it was interesting. He said, this is not my cup of tea, fellas. Go somewhere else. So we went somewhere else, and we were having a lot of trouble. But then somebody said, why don't you see about if you can get Jerome Robbins? Well, Robbins was interested, and once Robbins was interested, then Hal Prince became interested again, and he became our producer.
Mm-hmm. And I believe Jerome Robbins had a lot of input into the shaping of the staging, of course. He was the director, choreographer, but the opening number tradition was his concept, basically.
Oh, he made us start from the beginning. We started having meetings maybe 6 months before we were to go into rehearsal, and every meeting started with the same question, what is this show about? And we, of course, would say, well, it's about this dairyman and his daughters, three of whom are marriageable, and Robbins would say, no, that's the plot. That is not what gives these stories their power. And so week after week when we met, he would ask the same question until one of us finally said, hey, you know what this is about? It's about the changing of the way of life of these people as new ideas came into play and traditions changed. And then Robbins said, that's absolutely right. And therefore, he looked at Jerry Bock and me, and he said, you two have to write me an opening number which shows the audience, which talks about the changing of tradition and which shows the audience what some of these traditions are.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, that choreography has become so iconic that I think most revivals have reused Jerome Robbins' concept, haven't they?
Well, up until very recently, the Jerome Robbins Foundation insisted that if you did the show, you had to recreate Robbins' choreography exactly. They've begun to be a little more relaxed about it and allow people, in certain instances, to experiment with other choreography. But generally, they're required to stick pretty close to what Robbins did. And I don't mind because what he did was brilliant.
Indeed. And Zero Mostel, of course, was the first Tevier on Broadway, and he won a Tony Award for Best Actor in a Musical that year. When did he come into the picture as being the logical person to play the role of Tevier?
Well, Jerry Bock and I, we had done a show called Fiorello, which featured an actor named Howard Da Silva, and we thought he would be the perfect Tevye. And so we recommended to Robbins that we use Howard Da Silva. And Robbins' answer was, Howard is wonderful, but Howard is life-size, and I think Tevye should be larger than life, and that's why I want to use Zero Mostel. And there's no question but what Zero Mostel was larger than life.
Mm-hmm. And in writing the songs, I believe you tailored some of the songs for his particular performance style.
Well, one song in particular, If I Were a Rich Man, knowing that it was going to be Zero, I called for animal noises, and I thought there was a place where he can probably cross his eyes. I did tailor it for him. And as a matter of fact, Zero did me a huge favor. At rehearsal one day, I was watching him do the song, and I thought, I gave the song a serious ending, and the song is so charming and droll, maybe it should be droll throughout. So after the rehearsal, when Zero and Hal Prince and Robbins were all together, I suggested that I change the song and rewrite it so that it remained droll from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And Zero looked at me and he yelled at me. He said, if you do that, then you don't understand this man. It's the serious ending that's the real Tevye. It's not he said the droll part is charming, but it's a serious ending, which really is so don't you dare change that. He did me a favor.
Yes, indeed. Although I believe as the run went on and became so longer that Zero Mostel, as actors do in a long run, began to play up a little and toy around with the part.
Well, Zero was notorious for that. The audiences loved him no matter what he did, but we were annoyed because, for instance, an actor in a scene would turn to deliver a line to Zero, and he'd be on the other side of the stage. He did all sorts of crazy things. The audience adored him, but we didn't. But the problem was, and I didn't know this, I found out this later, Zero had been run over a bus prior to going into rehearsal for Fiddler.
Oh, dear.
We didn't know this.
Yeah.
And he was run over by a bus on a February day when the bus skidded up over a curb. He was taken to the hospital, and he was conscious when he heard the doctor saying, we have to amputate.
Oh.
And he begged them. He said, I'm a performer. Please save the leg.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they did manage to save the leg. But what was miraculous was to see Zero dancing on stage. Then when he went into the wings, his dresser would be there with a cane, and he would limp back to the dressing room.
Yeah.
After eight and a half months, his doctor said, Mr. Mostel cannot do 8 performances a week like this. So Hal let him out of his contract, and he sent him on the road in a road production where he only had to do three or four performances a week.
Yes.
And that he could handle, with his bad leg.
Mm-hmm.
So he really was only in the show about not quite 9 months.
Ah, right. And then Herschel Bernardi and various others took over in a long line of Tevyes.
Right, we had about 8 of them.
And of the original cast, Maria Karnilova also won a Tony for Best Featured Actress in a Musical, but interestingly, looking down the cast list, we also had a future opera singer in Julia McGainis as the original Hoddle, and of course the famous Beatrice Arthur as Yenta the Matchmaker.
Right, it was a wonderful cast. B. Arthur had auditioned I don't know how many times. Every time she auditioned, all of us would say, well, she's wonderful, but she's kind of New York. She's not like old Europe. But nobody was as strong as Bea. So finally, Robin said, let's cast her. And we did, and she was just wonderful in the role.
Mm-hmm. And to your working methods with writing the score of Fiddler on the Roof, I believe the method was that Jerry Bock would go away, write the musical themes, and then he would give a tape of his musical themes to you, and you would pick out the tunes that you thought best suited certain songs, and sometimes the tunes themselves would inspire you to write certain songs.
Well, that's the way we started, mm-hmm. Jerry would send me tapes. He was very generous because on a tape there might be 8 to a dozen songs, and I might only use 1 or 2 of those melodies that would coincide with lyric ideas I had. But always, at a certain point in the writing, I would have an idea for a lyric, and I thought, I do not want to be handcuffed by the music. I want the freedom to write this and carpenter it and change it and play with it. And so I finally wrote a lyric, and I gave it to Jerry to set. I was so used to hearing the music first, and that was always wonderful. I thought, I wonder whether he can set a lyric that I give him and have the lyric come first. Mm-hmm. And so I gave him the lyric, and when he set it, I thought, he can do both. His setting was just wonderful.
Ah, great. And the approach to writing the lyrics to the particular songs, I believe some of the songs in Fiddler are particularly personal to you, such as Sunrise, Sunset, and Do You Love Me? So I guess those lyrics sort of come naturally, do they? Things that you're able to relate to your own family situation.
Well, Do You Love Me in particular, I was thinking of my own parents and my Jewish background. There was a lot of that in the show. I had three sources. One was my own life. One was the Sholem Aleichem stories, which had a lot of very rich material to borrow from. And one was a book called Life is with People. There was an anthropologist, a team of young anthropologists, and it was the beginning of World War II, and people were streaming out of their home countries. There were a lot of refugees, and a lot of them were coming to America. And these two people, they interviewed these Jewish refugees, and they expected to find differences, great differences, in the communities that they came from, the different countries. Mm-hmm. And they were surprised to find that basically the differences were smaller than the similarities in all these communities. But that was a sociological book, and it was very rich in material that we were able to use and incorporate into the lyrics and into the show generally. It was a wonderful source of information.
Yes, I guess, the Russian pogroms of 1905 and the Jewish communities at the time sort of have a universal theme to them, the Jewish situation all over the world.
It did. I'm suddenly reminded, I was watching the show one night, and sitting across the aisle from me was an elderly couple. They looked like they had just come out of a concentration camp. They were gaunt. They were elderly and gaunt. Mm-hmm. And towards the end of the first act, there is a pogrom, and the Russian hooligans took the pillows, the bride and groom's, the gifts that they'd been given, pillows stuffed with goose down, and they ripped them open, and there was these feathers flying all over the stage. And this couple across the aisle from me started to gasp, and I thought, oh my God, they are living. They're living an experience. And I thought, I hope they survive this evening. It was frightening and very moving.
Mm-hmm. And you're quoted as saying that in writing the songs for Perchik, well, you didn't really have any experience of what revolutionaries were like, so you sort of had to read up the background of it and sort of get into the sense of the type of song that Perchik would sing.
Well, Norman Jewison, who directed the film, he told me, he said, Sheldon, you've given this revolutionary, he doesn't sing a revolutionary song, he has a romantic song. Uh-huh. Give him a revolutionary song. So Jerry and I wrote him a revolutionary song, but Jewison cast an actor who didn't sing very well. And when Jewison realized that the film was a little long and had to be cut, that song got cut, and after hearing the actor sing it, I thought it's a good thing it was cut.
Oh, well, I was going to pay the 30th anniversary edition of the film soundtrack, and it includes that cut song with Paul Michael Glazer, who's best remembered, I guess, these days for Starsky and Hutch.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, he was a wonderful actor, and he was terrific in the show, but a first-rate singer, he was not.
No. Any Day Now is the name of the song. And, of course, as you mentioned in the stage production, it was Now I Have Everything, which I guess was more romantic style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And speaking to Michael Levine, who I believe is a good friend of yours, and he's a collector of sheet music, of songs which were cut from Broadway musicals, and he mentioned there are a couple of songs cut on the road, one for Laser Wolf and one for Mottle the Tailor. When did they come about, and when did you realize the songs weren't working and perhaps needed to be cut from the stage production?
Well, we had written one song we had written for the tailor all during the first act. He talks about wanting to get a sewing machine. And then finally he saves his pennies and he buys a sewing machine in act, and we see the machine in act two. So Jerry Bock and I wrote him a song that he could sing with his wife called Dear Sweet Sewing Machine. And it was one of the hits of the backers auditions. People just loved it. Jerry had written a kind of disguised jazz waltz. The first city we went to on our pre-Broadway tour was Detroit, and we were horrified. They sang the number, Dear Sweet Sewing Machine, and there was almost no applause. So we thought, well, obviously the audience is not hearing the lyric properly. So we went to the orchestra conductor and said, it's probably too fast and it's too loud. So take it slower and make the orchestra softer. Mm-hmm. So that's what he did. And the second night, there was the same lack of applause. And Jerry Robbins said, well, the song is not working for some reason. So it was cut. It was just dropped from the show as soon as possible. But we had many postmortems thinking, why is this not working, this song that was so successful at our backers auditions? Mm-hmm. And I think it was Jerome Robbins who put his finger on it. He said, I think the problem is this. There are three daughters, and each one has a story. The story of the tailor and his wife is resolved at the end of Act One when they get married.
Yes.
Their story, in effect, is over. Now we go on to the second daughter, Huddle. So he said, in the second act, you cannot give them a major number. The audience doesn't want to hear it. They're interested in what's going to happen to Huddle, so they just are not interested. And I think that was the case. Then there was another song. We had written, there's a tragic moment towards the end of the show when the whole village is told they're going to have to leave in 3 days. They're going to have to sell their houses and just get out. And we had written two songs. One was called Get Thee Out, a bitter song that the villagers sang. And the other one was a song we wrote for the rabbi, a philosophical, a kind of amusing song about, well, this is the history of the Jewish history, and so we might as well, we're used to it, let's pack. Mm-hmm. And it was that also was one of the hits of the backers auditions because of its droll quality. It was a kind of a bittersweet song and funny song. Everybody loved it. And again, we get to Detroit. Well, by that time, we had taken it away from the rabbi and we had given it to Zero Mostelas Tevye to sing.
Yes.
And Zero sang it, and there was almost no response. There certainly was no laughter. And that one we tried for 3 or 4 nights, and it kept getting the same lack of response. Well, people would come in from New York to see the show, see how the show was doing, and we would ask them, we said, why isn't this song working? It was so successful at the backers auditions. And these people would look at us as if we were crazy, and they'd say, you're so foolish. This is a tragic moment in the show. These people are asked to leave their homes, leave everything behind, and get out. And you're giving them a kind of a comedy song. Nobody wants to laugh. Nobody wants to hear that song.
Mm-hmm.
And so that song was cut, too, although Zero Mostel fought for it up to the last minute. He loved the song. He loved singing it, but we had to take it away from him.
Indeed.
And by the way, I still do that song every so often at a gala, a benefit or something. I will sing that song, and out of context, it works wonderfully. But in context, it didn't work at all.
Yes, it didn't suit the mood of the piece at that particular juncture.
Not at all.
Well,
yeah.
The third daughter goes against complete tradition by marrying outside the faith when she falls in love with a young Russian. And, of course, we have the Shava ballet sequence. Was there any thoughts about giving that couple a song?
Yeah, it's actually pronounced Chava.
Chava.
We had thought about it. We couldn't find the song to do. And then Robbins said, don't worry about it because I'm going to have a little dance for all three daughters and it'll feature Chava. So don't worry about giving her a song. Instead, we had given Tevye a very long song, a complaint about after his daughter runs off and he has, by tradition, the Orthodox tradition, he declared his daughter dead. So we gave him this long song, and Robbins cut it down. He eliminated about 90% of it, and what's left is very short and very effective. But that was one of Robbins' talents, knowing what would work on stage and what would not work on stage.
Mm-hmm. And, well, the stage production, as I mentioned, was the longest-running musical of its time, and it was still running in 1972. And when did the rights for the film version come up? Generally, I think they prefer to release film after the Broadway run is finished, but the film was actually made before the Broadway run had been finished.
Right. The film was released while the stage production was still running, and as a matter of fact, I have a photograph which I love, where you can see the marquee of the film and the marquee of the theater where the stage production was playing, both in the same film. That was exciting for me.
Indeed, great, and it's a remarkably faithful adaptation too from the stage. It must be said, of course, done in cinematic terms rather than in stage terms.
Oh, I thought that Norman Jewison did a wonderful job in making that into a film. It is so cinematic. It could have been just a filmed stage play, and that would have been death. But what he did was wonderful. He made it into a genuine movie.
Mm-hmm. And apart from the alternate song that you wrote for Perchik, were you asked to write any additional songs for the film version?
No. Originally, Jewison, we had a meeting with him, and he said, if you have any ideas that you would like me to think about for the film, please tell them to me. But Jerry Bock and I, we were so wed to the stage play, we didn't see it in film terms at all, so we contributed nothing. But he did hire Joe Stein, who had done the libretto for the stage production, and Joe did the script for the film, and he worked with Jewison, and he too thought cinematically and made it into a film.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, one of the songs cut from the film, which I guess had more of a stage background, was the gossip song in the second act, I Just Heard, sung by Yenta and the Villagers. Was that additionally put in the stage production to give Beatrice Arthur a song to sing, or was it to cover a scene change or a costume change or something of that nature?
It was done for two reasons. One was that the second act, you seem to be familiar with the show, and you know, the second act gets darker and darker and darker and culminates in the village being expelled and having to leave. So we thought, what we need is a touch of humor. So we wrote the rumor song to be kind of an active song and to be amusing. But also we discovered that it was very useful for a scene change. Well, of course, when Jewison made the movie, he didn't need a song to cover a scene change, because with film, you can just go from here to there with in seconds. So he didn't use the song. And subsequent to that, a lot of productions thought, well, maybe the song is unnecessary, and they dropped it.
Yeah.
But I saw a production in Stratford, Canada, at the Shakespeare Festival earlier this year, and they had restored the song, and they staged it in an unusual way, and it worked wonderfully. Well, we're supposed to have a revival next year, October, November of 2015. I've spoken to the director, and I said, I really would like the rumor song restored in this. And he said, fine, I'd love to do it. So I think it'll have a new life.
Ah, great. Yes, you mentioned I seem to be familiar with the show. Well, I've actually had the honour of performing in an amateur version locally in Australia some years ago.
Oh, who did you play?
I played the innkeeper, Mordka.
So oh, for heaven's sake.
Who has that nice little speech at the wedding about, you know, the ancestors, etc.
Yes, it may interest you to know that before we went into rehearsal, Jerry Bock and I went to see a benefit given for the Hebrew Actors Union in New York. And we went down to see if we could find any talent for the show. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, there was a man named Zvi Schuller, and we thought, he's perfect. And he did wind up in the show. He played the innkeeper, and then in the film, he plays the rabbi.
Oh, great. Uh-huh. So a bit of continuity there. And, of course, there was a bit of continuity from the fact that Topol played the role in the London production of Fiddler on the Roof.
Yes, my wife and I went over to see him, and I must say, he walked out on stage, and within 30 seconds, we were just hooked. We thought, oh, this man is just electric. He's charismatic.
Mm-hmm. Although there was some thought when the film production came along of having Zero Mostel repeat the role, but do you think that he might have been too large a performer for the screen?
Well, that's the question. The first question we asked Norman Jewison was, are you going to use Zero? And to our surprise, Jewison said, Zero is so large, larger than life, according to Jerome Robbins. He said, I wouldn't know how to work with him. He said, in my opinion, the only person who's used him successfully in film was Mel Brooks in The Producers.
Oh, yes, of course.
And he said, I don't think I have that talent, so I'm not going to use him. And Zero was just heartbroken. He was heartsick, as you can imagine.
Indeed. Yes, yes, indeed. Although these days, of course, the thing is to film productions on the stage. So I suppose if the technology had been around in those days, perhaps we might have even had a TV production of Zero playing the role on stage. But who knows?
Well, it has, you know, the Lincoln Center, the Performing Arts Library, maybe 20, 25 years ago, I've forgotten how long it's been going on, they suddenly got the funds to film a certain number of plays every year, mm-hmm. important plays. And there was a group of people, I was one of them, who were asked to vote and to recommend which plays should be filmed. And they've been doing that now for decades. And one of the films they filmed was Fiddler. Unfortunately, it wasn't they didn't film the production, the original Broadway production. Zero, as I say, had been sent on the road. And at one point, that production came back to New York and played some theater. And that's the production that was filmed. But by that time, I regret to say, Zero's performance was kind of mechanical. He knew where all the laughs were. He knew what the effect was. It was not particularly a fresh performance, and it wasn't vintage Zero. So it's interesting, but it's not the Zero that everybody loved on Broadway.
Indeed, didn't capture the same magic of the time.
Mm-hmm. No.
Well, as I mentioned, we'll be listening to the 1971 film soundtrack, which won an Academy Award for John Williams for Best Music Scoring Adaptation and Original Song Score. Did you have any work with John Williams, or did Jerry work with John Williams to produce the effects that he wanted, or did John Williams work on his own?
John Williams worked on his own. The only time that I had contact with him, they were going to film the song, they were going to record the song for Paul Glaser, the revolutionary song. And John called me and he said, "We need another half chorus. It's too short." And so I thought, oh my God, it's been years since I've been in the Fiddler mode. But I went to work. I worked all night long and I called, I forgot whether they were in London or in Ireland, wherever they were recording, and I dictated the additional lyrics, and he said thank you, and they did record it, and then it was cut. All my work was for nothing.
Indeed. And am I right in thinking that Fiddler on the Roof is the only film version of one of your musicals, albeit the fact that they did make a film version in New Faces in 1952, which you contributed a number of songs, but
unfortunately, you're absolutely right. We had requests to film both She Loves Me and Fiorello, but they wanted so many changes in the score. They wanted a real pop score instead of what we had done, that we turned them down. So I live in hope someday maybe somebody will get around to doing it, but so far you're right, Fiddler's the only one that's been filmed.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that was a very good experience, as you said, being so faithful to the stage production.
Our publisher at the time had been invited to see a preview of it out in New Jersey, and he couldn't go. So my wife and I went. We got in the car, and we drove out to New Jersey. And when Norman Jewison saw us there, he said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I haven't finished the film. It's still too long. I have to make cuts. You shouldn't be here." He said, "Oh, well, you're here. You might as well see it." So we saw the film, and he said, "I have to take out maybe 20 minutes," he said. "But, you know, film cutting is really an art. You can take out a half hour, and if you take out the wrong half hour, it'll seem like you've made the film longer."
Yes.
"Where you can take out the right 1 minute, and it'll seem like you've taken out 15 minutes." Ah. Well, he cut the film beautifully. The final version of the show is just, I think it's wonderful.
Ah, great. That's always satisfying to hear that the original creators of the production were satisfied with a film version, which isn't always the case.
No, so I'm told.
Well, in later years, Fiddler on the Roof entered the Opera House. Indeed, I had the pleasure of seeing the original Australian Tevye, Hayes Gordon, recreate his role of Tevye in the Australian Opera's production back in 1984. And is that a trend that you find happening around the world in various opera houses, that opera companies are taking over some of the traditional Broadway musicals?
I understand that's true. I don't know that Fiddler is particularly one of them that's done, but She Loves Me gets done. It's like an operetta. And, of course, West Side Story is done in opera houses. And I think Phantom of the Opera, there are a lot of them that are popping up in opera houses. I think that's a wonderful development.
Mm-hmm.
Hayes Gordon, now that you mention it, he was playing in Australia at the time when we were trying to make up our mind whether to go to Australia or Japan. And yes, I remember that name. And I was told that he was just wonderful.
Yes, indeed. Well, he did the original production for J.C. Williamson's back in 1967, and then he reprised it for the Australian Opera back in 1984. So I guess the only other actor is Topol, who also came to Australia to do a revival of Fiddler on the Roof, and I believe he's still doing productions around the world doing the role.
A couple of years ago, we saw Topol at the beginning of a tour, and we thought he had never been better. He was just wonderful. And then we were horrified to find that during the tour, apparently he was pulling the cart, which is one of the things that he's required to do, and he's hurt his shoulder so badly that he had to stop performing. And I was afraid that it had ended his career. And I was very relieved to find that about a year or two ago, he had recovered enough so that he was working again.
Ah, great. Uh-huh. And as you mentioned, there are thoughts about putting the gossip song back into Fiddler on the Roof. Have you been approached at any other stage to revise the production, or do you think the original production as it stands is well nigh perfect, that it shouldn't be meddled with?
Fiddler is one of the few shows I've done where we feel that there is no need to change it. And it's not necessarily what Joe Stein and Jerry Bock and I did, but it's what Jerome Robbins did. He was obsessive about the show, and what he helped all of us create was something that doesn't need to be changed.
Ah, great. Well, thank you very much for sparing your time in New York to speak to us here in Australia about Fiddler on the Roof in this year. It's a 50th anniversary year. And if you're available, Sheldon, I'd like to speak to you in the future about some of the other musicals that you collaborated with Jerry Bock, including Fiorello, Tenderloin, She Loves Me, and The Rothschilds and the Apple Tree.
I hope you get the chance. Also, 50 years from now, when we have the 100th anniversary of Fiddler, you and I will talk.
Absolutely. Well, we'll make that a date, shan't we?
Okay. And I hope that I can come to Australia and we can do this face-to-face.
Indeed. Yeah, that would be a great pleasure, too. Thank you very much, Sheldon, and have a great day in New York.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Right. Bye for now.